Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Stephen McCarthy, your host of the McCarthy Project, coming to you at a special time today with some really fantastic information related to training. I'm excited to have Cal Dietz on the phone today. And there are a few times in life when somebody really does look at things differently. And I really feel that after today's show, you'll see that there is some new technology, not based on a fad or based on a specific piece of equipment, that there is another level to training methodology that if your coach or a staff member of yours would take the time to look into, you'll see that there's a lot of depth beyond this. So I've asked Cal to come in on the show today and talk specifically about his book, Triphasic Training, and kind of a little bit of his methodology behind it and why it does work. You know, it's funny, if you just type in triphasic training on the internet, you will find numerous positive reviews from neutral third parties. And I think that's probably the biggest testament of anything is when you actually get people that are not associated with you. It's funny because one of the top ones said, hey, I don't get any money. I don't have any ties to it, but this is what I found, and it's fantastic. So today, Cal will be joining us, and just to kind of give you a little bit of background on Cal, Cal is currently the one of the strength coaches down at the University of Minnesota in charge of Olympic sports. He has over 400 All-Americans, Hobie Baker Award winners, people that played in the NFL, NHL, NBA, I think you got every letter on the book now that I think about it. But so he really does have a very a large amount of information, a lot of depth. So what we're going to go into is we're going to be about 45 minutes. We're going to start kind of general, and then we're going to dig down into some of the details. So, Cal, how are you doing today?
Doing well. Thank you for having me on today. It's a pleasure to be here. And, you know, in Minnesota here, we're just fighting snowstorms right now in April, so pretty amazing.
It's funny because for all you listeners that have heard me whine and complain about the weather all week, I'm sure they're probably looking at me going, just give it up. But when it snows and blizzards as many times as it has in the last week, when you're expecting spring, it does get to be a point where you say no mas for sure.
Yeah, it's definitely time to surrender. I believe it was 200 days since the first snowfall. So that's more than half the year.
That's very true. All righty. So today we're going to be talking about triphasic training, your book. And I think in general what I'd like to do is kind of give us a little feel for your background. I mean, you're not just somebody that, you know, has sat in a collegiate setting, you know, in a more administrative role and just thinking about it. You've been, you know, sort of in the trenches for quite a long time. And how did this, or, you know, I guess, what is the motivation for the book to start with?
Well, I guess, you know, I had so many inquiries about my methods and theories, and I'd spoken all around the country about them. And I had a lot of requests, and it was actually, you know, nothing you could cover in a all the methods you couldn't cover in a 10-minute segment on the phone. So I realized there might be a demand for it, and the hopes was that you know, more than two people would buy my book, which I thought my grandmother and mother, obviously. But, you know, it seemed, and these weren't anything, you know, all the methods that I'd placed together, essentially what it was I used various methods, and I have a lot of high-end strength coaches call me and say, Cal, I've used all these methods before, but you put them in a sequence that seemed to be the most effective. And I'd ran across the sequencing about 12 years ago, and had just been refining it ever since with all the athletes that we train between me and my assistants. And again, this book isn't Cal Dietz. It's been all my assistants and all the athletes that have been experimental projects over the years that made this come to fruition, I guess. You know, that's the backbone of this book. So, and, you know, experiments, things that didn't work, things that worked, hoping to get results. It worked for some, it didn't work for others. And what I came down to is basically the foundation of the book, the triphasic movements, which are obviously three basic movements that you have to train to make elite human performance, and or just fundamental movements for high school kids, even junior high kids. And we can get in more of that later, but that was the foundation of the book so that I could share the ideas. And, you know, since the foundation and since I released it, I've actually had people send me programs that I would consider even better than mine and ideas that are better than mine with the whole concept once I released it. So I'm really actually even refining my methods and things more because people are sharing ideas with me that they've came across because I shared my book with them. So I've been very fortunate. I gave a ton of information out there, and I've been able to receive a ton of information back, and which will be upgrades and new things into the second book, which will be basically, you know, in the energy system and bioenergetics and biochemistry of training, but it all ties in with the system. So,
you know, that's the amazing part about this is that they're really. Well, before we go down there, before we get into the nuts and bolts, you know, you had mentioned that you've been over the last 12 years. Kind of give everybody an idea of, you know, what you did on a daily basis to kind of put this all together. Because I think you're being overly gracious to say, well, it's just something that's been out there. Well, if it was just something that was out there, then somebody would have done it, so to speak. But what is it that, how did you go through the, were you just curious by nature, or was it something that, you know, hey, I really want to get this one particular guy better, and this is what I happened upon? Or how did it kind of come together?
Well, you know, I early in your coaching career, or at least mine anyway, I really didn't care about anything else other than coaching. And I was somewhat obsessive compulsive, I guess, about learning and trying to get better and always constantly reading. And so I would take theories and so forth and put them together. And, you know, honestly, I'd work Sunday nights, you know, and I met my wife and she was training for the Olympics. So we didn't get to spend all the time together. So I didn't have a family, didn't have really a lot going on. And I literally sent every night, reading, researching. We'd coach during the day, and I didn't have the staff that I had now as back then, but I mean, I think we even had more athletes back then, but you know, and you can't, it's hard to service them as well, but we would coach a lot, and my assistants and I would evaluate everything literally, and we just basically went through checklists essentially and saying, hey, this doesn't work, this seems to work. We got responses later, and it was really trial and error of what worked, what didn't. And then eventually the science caught, well, science didn't catch up with us. Maybe we found it. Maybe science did catch up with us. We found some things out in, that was published in 2005, which we got a hold of later, that backed up what we did, but it was essentially coaching using methods that seemed to work and work very well, and then ultimately digging through the science to find out why it worked, which also helped. So this is how this all came to fruition, I should say. And I don't know, in my regards to just constantly learning, trying to get better, pushing myself to read at night, you know, not watching a TV show that everybody's watching and reading books. Now I have a family, so it's a little different. Last night I went out and played baseball instead of reading. But you know, there's and it's hard because still in this profession, I still have the drive to get better and read more. But you know, last night I went home, did emails for 2 hours, played baseball for an hour and a half in my driveway because the snow is too deep still. But and then we were able to and then I put my kids to bed, do a few more emails, and then go to sleep to get up the next day at 5 and start over. So
see, that's the part that, you know, even as an aspiring coach like myself, you sit there and watch that amount of that body of work that you were able to accomplish at that time in your life, and it really does take that amount of time of just dumping it. It's not that you didn't probably understand each one of the concepts in themselves, but it takes that time for it to kind of mull around in there, sit in there. And I think what's beautiful about it is that you actually had a chance to apply it too, you know, because there's such a world of fitness that is so faddish. How did you get around the fad thing, or did you just say, you know what, I'm not even going to go there, I already could tell? Or how did you get around to being the Bosu ball of all training, you know, kind of concepts, if you will?
Right, and that's why, you know, chapter one came to fruition in the book, I guess, because if you look at this and you realize that, and you try it, that there is, you know, we can throw functional training in there, the Bosu ball stuff, the rehabilitation shift, paradigm shift, to train that way. And you know what, I even train that time that way a little bit during the course of the year to get my athletes in shape, because I think it's a full systemic stress to the body, which essentially, as I say that, about 3 or 4 weeks of the year is all that stuff is truly effective. And then you can't get much more out of it, because why? It is not applying enough stress. So at that point, I realized that the amount of stress that needed to be applied to the body was the key to getting athletes better. So, and with that in mind, the functional training, there's systemic heart rate stress and aerobic training, but it's not necessarily enough stress to have a world-class sprinter apply more force to the ground to become faster. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is, you know, we talked about in our earlier show today, so many things that we're going to come across. And one of them primarily is this idea of working hard in the proper way. There are so many kids out there doing the ball 12 months out of the year. And we learned it, unfortunately, as a young company, that it was great. People enjoyed it for about the first 3 or 4 weeks. They got the benefit, but then they seemed to stagnate. And it's funny because our whole philosophy was based on it. So unfortunately, we had to come to the realization that we didn't know what we were talking about, which was very hard. But what you're saying is that each little piece, each little fad may have a piece. It doesn't mean it has to go away, if you will. But you can't jump on board and think that if you just do the ball the rest of your life that you're going to be a better athlete.
Well, and, you know, that's the hard part. You know, if there's a new fad, there's a tool. And if you can understand what the tool or the method, what stress it applies and what it's actually doing, then you can apply it into your system or the type of year. You know, I visited strength coaches all across the country. And, you know, you may run across one who says, I really like this method, and this is why I think it works and so forth. But, I I'm not sure he's using it, or maybe they don't know why it works yet. But I didn't. And when I found out why it would work, then you're sitting there going, okay, is that the right time of the year to apply it? You know what I'm saying? It may work, but there may be a better time of the year to apply it. So when you look at my system, and it just each stage sets up another stage for better performance, and that's the goal.
And one other general question before we kind of go down more specifically some of the chapters and some of the information is, talk to us a little bit about the difference. You know, like this morning's show was about the sports specificity thought. You know, is there such a thing as training for a particular sport? And give us your thoughts in relation to how that works for a young athlete, maybe 14 to 17, to a college athlete, to a pro athlete. How does that idea of sports specificity and your training methods tie together?
So, really, if you're looking at a young athlete perspective, it's what you really want to do. When I say general, the biggest thing that is differentiation in sports is speed and performance. Obviously, that's the most important thing. Now, as a young athlete, you're going to think, okay, I need to get better at speed. But, however, there's a number of formulas out there. Biomechanists have discovered this. The Soviets knew it in 1960, that you actually need to generate more force and to become faster. You actually need a certain level of strength. And so right there tells you that, but however, most people want to work speed, they're going to go out and run. But if they're very weak, they can never develop the amount of speed that they wish to get to. You will hit your ceiling very quickly, so you need to have some level of strength. And actually, I've never had a young athlete come in that couldn't benefit from getting stronger. So yes, you do need to get stronger, and that's being specific towards the individual. Okay, mm-hmm. And then after you get strong, then you need to work more speed. And you don't need to get too strong. How strong is strong enough? There's formulas for that. There's ways. But usually around 6 to 8 weeks of getting stronger will help. And then you address speed. And then you, for 4 to 6 weeks, and you come back and address strength, and you'll keep building your pyramid base bigger and bigger so that you can get better and better at the end. That's the goal. Sports specificity, you know, everyone wants to say it. But until the most specific stuff would come at the end of a training cycle, end of like 3 to 5 months, that is actually specific, I truly believe, to the individual in that sport. So if it's, let's say in hockey, if it's hip flexor, or even in running too, if it's the hip flexor that needs more performance, then there's very specific hip flexor work you need to do for that. Not that you're not doing hips flexor all the time, because at first you want to make them stronger, then at the end you want to do a very high speed hip flexor movement to make their running and or skating faster, if that's what they need to make themselves more specific and more sports oriented performance for the individual. So to me, it eventually gets to the highest levels of coaching. It comes down to an individual basis to make that athlete better in their sport, not necessarily doing sport-specific movements that they do every day in the sport that is not going to make them better.
Yes, and I think that's, you know, it's such a, it's almost like a double-edged sword on a word, if that's right, is that you say one thing, it could mean that, could mean this, but
yes.
It's hyped up as this marketing thing where, you know, I have sport-specific training over here because I played hockey when I was young and I played NHL when I was older. And so I know what it's like to be a hockey player, and therefore I'm specific to hockey. And really, it's pretty much should stay right there in that marketing field, because it really only, the card only needs to be played at certain times, and sometimes not at all for youngers, but a lot more for older, maybe pro athletes. And it seems as though that, you know, you need to have a philosophy that encompasses all of them, not just one particular group of athletes.
Yeah, and that's correct. That's why I feel that the triphasic system will address many of those qualities in all levels, and we've seen it in all levels. I've implemented with thousands of high school athletes over the years, with people using my methods and my own facilities to advance the level athletes. If they train hard, they will get results.
Done. All right, so let's go to a quick break then, and then we'll come back and talk about the specifics. You know, maybe the first, you know, couple of chapters, just to talk about what, just to kind of give people a taste of some of the ideas that you're bringing to the table and a combination of theories. So we'll be right back in about a minute and finish up with Cal Dietz and triphasic training. Five Star Basketball, the leader in basketball instruction and camps. Endorsed by Michael Jordan, Dick Vitale, and Hubie Brown, and where the teaching never stops. Five Star Basketball Minnesota will be hosting a one-day instructional camp on May 18th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. and will be hosted by Five Star, The McCarthy Project, and Grassroots Hoops. For more information on the camp, visit themccarthyproject.com/5-star. XL Athlete is the leading provider of online strength and conditioning and speed development camps. For more information on their training programs and speed development camps, visit xlathlete.com. Alrighty, we are back. This is Stephen McCarthy from the McCarthy Project, where we have been attacking life and sport for the last 10, almost 12 years now, since 2001. We have Cal Dietz with us today, and he is the author of Triphasic Training. He has worked with hundreds of All-Americans and Big Ten athletes and Players of the Year and every sport at a pro level. And so he really does have this body of information from experience, and as well as a time invested. And I think that's the biggest thing that I've enjoyed talking with Cal about, is that he's invested the time to try these ideas and put them into place and formulate great opinions. So for this next segment, we're going to go down into the kind of more the science aspect of it. So from the first chapter is basic concepts. So kind of give us, Cal, a little bit of feel of what basic concepts, what are kind of your building blocks, I guess?
Well, the foundation of my programs, if you look at what we do and why we get results, is that I will actually use methods to apply more stress where, again, people, as you said before, they just the concept of working hard is great, but it actually comes back to the intensity of stress, and that's the key that everybody kind of leaves off. You know, what's more, you know, intense is doing a bunch of in sprints or running 5 miles. Well, the sprints are more intense. The 5 miles are maybe a harder workout over the duration, but what's going to make you faster? Running the sprints, obviously. But the foundation of that stress in chapter one is about basically just getting an understanding of how your body responds to it. And then what we did was work with how the body responds to it basically on a weekly model. And I chose, you know, the weekly versus a monthly model at first, just because, well, that's how we train on a week-to-week basis, with a rest on the weekends or on Sunday. But with the organization of stress and understanding how it works, it seemed to be very effective, which actually ties into the undulated model. So with how your body works during the course of a week and the undulated model, what we chose was that we're going to work the most important qualities at the beginning of the week, okay? And this really comes all the way back to the 40s and 50s to the horse training. What people will sometimes have a tendency to do is they run exactly how they want the horse to run in the race. Then they do, and that would, let's say, example, that's on a Monday. So if I chose a load that I wanted my athletes and an intensity that I wanted them at, ideally you want the best one on Monday. And then what you do is they call the second day, or let's say Wednesday for simplistic reasons, and there's many models for this, everyday models. But then the second day, they called, the horse community would call it under-distance training. Well, they knew they had to do short-distance training for the horses, and or in humans, it's a greater intensity with less duration. So then this is really the undulation here. So then you start at medium, where you want to be, and then you shorten everything up with greater intensity. And then the only other thing to do to go away from those two is to go with less intensity but larger volume. And the reason that worked with the stress model was that the volume day was at the end of the week, and you trained people with more volume when they're tired. Okay, so you save, really, you're adjusting the model so that all the quality of work is done in the beginning of the week. And then the latter part of the week, when the athlete is tired, you're training conditioning and high volume, which the athlete needs, especially in the off season, during that time. So that therefore helps you adapt to the stress, because your body's, that you're working it in the exact state that the body's in for performance and stress. Of the high stress of the volume also at the end of the week. And then after the high volume, you're able to come back and recover. So let me give you a couple parameters. If you have a 200-meter runner, you'd run 200s on Monday, you'd run maybe hundreds or flying 30s or something less than the 200 on Wednesday, and then you might run 300 or 400s on Friday. And that's the theory. And it seems to show up in many models across the world in different variations of training. I just kind of put it together for people and made that model somewhat effective in performance training in regards to weightlifting.
See, another thing too is that you mentioned a couple times, you literally have even crossed industries, because training thoroughbred horses is obviously a whole other industry than thoroughbred athletes. But in a lot of ways, they're the same. But that's not your normal connection point, you know, if you will.
Right. And the thing with horses is, and I use some of my, my nutrition stuff comes from some horse experts. And here's the thing. If you test for, so horses, they can't talk, okay? Obviously, they can't, unless you're watching TV, okay? But the key with the horses is that there's no placebo effect, okay? So there's not all these emotions. There might be some, but these horses are usually stress-free. They're living in stables. They eat decently good food. But so the models that they come up with are true training models without the human factor involved. So that the human, you know, doesn't break up with his girlfriend. He doesn't have too many beers, or the horse doesn't break up with his girlfriend. He doesn't have too many beers the night before. You know, the training model is pretty controlled. And when that model comes out, that seems to be somewhat effective. Okay. And with that in mind, it seemed to work well with other people or my athletes. And when I say that, so there are other parameters. The Bulgarians did it a little differently, which I originally tried, but they did the volume, the Friday workout on Monday, and it was too much for my athletes. And the reason for that is they used drugs, and my athletes are drug free. So this seemed to work with my athletes better than the classic Bulgarian undulated model. And with regards to that, it just works, like I said, from the beginning, it worked better with the stress and the orientation of how the body adapts to that stress. And the horse model, again, the horse is, it's controlled. There's no, you know, and so I use the nutrition people, for example. If you give a horse a vitamin, it doesn't know it's getting a vitamin. And if it's running faster because of that vitamin, then you have figured out some things that were wrong with that horse or deficiencies that make it run faster. Now, they do a lot of testing with blood and hair analysis on horse, so it's not like you're just giving it blind vitamins. They were actually testing it and analyzing it. But anyway, so long story short, this is what I had to do in my programming is test, analyze, look at it. I don't have to do a lot of that anymore. We're fortunate that I did a lot of that early when I had lots and lots of time to do that. Now we can just see the effects, and we understand. So if I try a new principle, I have the understanding of why everything works. The new principle may be better, and we'll know it's better because we'll get great results, but ultimately we know why it's working, because we're not adding something that we have no basic foundation of why it worked, why it doesn't work, or why it works.
And I have more of a curiosity question. How do you define it working or not working?
Well, what we're looking for, so for example, I just implemented I got some results from some coaches. I gave the method to, and it was really more of a cluster potentiation method. So basically, my French contrast is one of the highly sought after, and it's not mine. It came from a French researcher named Giles Cometti, as I mentioned in my book, and it's a very effective method now for building speed. It's one of the most effective methods I've ever seen, and many people have confirmed this through emails. And it's really just a series of say, for example, it's a back squat. Then you go do a quick hurdle hop, and then you do a slightly loaded plyometric, like a jump squat with like 40, 50, 80 pounds, and you go back to maybe another hurdle hop set, and then you rest 4 or 5 minutes. Well, what we're doing is we're breaking that up into really small components, and we're doing it over a number of times, and it seems to be even more effective. And I'll actually probably release that soon as a publication within the next week or two, possibly on my website or some other websites. And we can actually release it on the McCarthy Project site too.
I appreciate that. All right, So let's kind of move to, because one of the words you've used quite frequently is stress, you know, and there are good stresses and bad stresses, and I'm sure you've taken the time to look at those. Give us an idea about that whole concept, the good, the bad, the ugly, I suppose.
Well, the stress, the way to look at it, its highest levels and where I think the direction of science has to go to make athletes better. So the good stress is stress that the athlete can heal from. Maybe it's a good workout. Maybe it's one that they like. Now, the bad stress, it can be the same workout 2 days later. But if the athlete, again, broke up with their girlfriend, if they drank too much, if they're starting to get overtrained, then it can become a bad stressor. And instead of recovering in 2 days, it may take 7 days to recover. Okay, but again, if the athlete doesn't like the workout or doesn't like to train and you stress, and let's say you have two identical athletes and you stress them the same, but one loves a workout and one didn't, it's actually harder on the athlete that doesn't like the workout because there's more stress involved in that athlete during that workout. So it's going to affect him negatively, I should say more, because all stress will affect negative and then eventually hope there's a compensation and come back to the positive effect. But so I think the future will be looking at gene expression, interpretations of the stress, how the organism, the person, may interpret that stress, and then ultimately respond to it to make sure that response is a positive response and or negative. So you may give a person a brief personality test that day to say, hey, they're in a bad mood, it's not going to, you know, and then modify their workout. You don't cancel the workout because you can actually modify it so that it is, maybe it's aerobic, so that it helps them recover from that stress. So instead of giving them the normal workout that's going to stress them and hurt them and it takes 5 days to recover, you actually give them an aerobic workout which will recover them and they can come in tomorrow and do the workout that you planned. So you're just delaying it a brief day. And that's the future. As they get into genetic testing and so forth and gene expression, I think that'll be the future of where training goes.
But then how do we, in this, sorry to interrupt you, but how in today's world do you actually monitor so that you can make a judgment to say, okay, yes, that athlete didn't recover or, you know, was stressed too much based on, you know, the variables that we've discussed. How do you actually measure that?
Well, so you can do some things a number of ways in regards to, so I used to take vertical jump and then we just follow that, and when they got tired the vertical jump went down and it wouldn't be as high as they were before. Well, I can actually just see it in their bodies from the way their posture is, the way when they jump over, let's say, a hurdle, it takes them so long in between much more longer in between the hurdles, because I call it reactiveness. They're not very reactive. When they first start training and they're healthy and they're good, they actually look like rubber balls bouncing through the hurdles or a cartoon character. And eventually they look like sandbags kind of going through the hurdles. That's an extreme, but you can see the difference. So I can see it. I know as I say in my book, like the fourth week of triphasic training, you actually start to become overtrained in some capacity. So then you're able to see it. Everyone sees it. I point it out. But we only have 2 more weeks left, and then we take a week off. So we push through those 2 weeks, and then when they come back, that's why with triphasic training, many people have called me, Cal, I tested on week 6 and 7, and results weren't quite what I thought they would be. Well, wait till week 8 and 9. Well, they give them some time off, and boom, they come back, and then now they're 6 or 8 inches on the vertical. Go ahead.
It's interesting to see when you, like, I think today society almost moves too fast, and they don't take the time to do this deep level testing and understanding of what is actually happening. They're just saying, well, I'm reading Mel Sipp's book, and he told me that was a good idea, you know, and that's the depth that we get to. We just don't have the time to go to the next level, which is, I'm fascinated by that.
You know, here's what people have to keep in mind. Training is a process. Okay, so if I'm training my 7-year-old son right now, I have to look at it and maybe, you know, if he wants to play sports for the next 20 years and he's allowed to, then that is a 20-year process. And, you know, you'd hope you'd get it right, but you never know. You know, that I may get it right, I may get it wrong in some capacity. You know you're going to get it wrong in some form or capacity because you can't do it right all the time. So what's the optimal workout? Everyone's kind of looking for that. Well, it's so individual and it's so specific that if I'm training one athlete and he gets some negative responses in white blood cell count, I know I might not, I've went too far, but I can only learn what that is until after the workout happens. So the next time I have to realize where he's at, but then the next time we don't get a response, I might be training him too light because he's in a better position to handle more stress. So I don't, you know, the future's going to change. I mean, the training world, I believe with technology as they integrate it, is going to change at breakneck speeds. The hopes is that we can just become more efficient and proficient at judging what the athlete needs that day when he walks in and to be a better athlete on that particular day and time.
Because ultimately, isn't that what the Bulgarians were using way back in the 60s? They felt each day needed to be assessed, and then you base your workout based on that day. Is that the starting point of the philosophy, or did they not have the technology to go, or did they say, hey, man,
Yeah, so it was brutal, though, what they did. Understand, they went and maxed out, got close to the max, and judged the workout that day. So that is a method, but understand those people, their strength coach's nickname was the Butcher. And because of that, his athletes were pushed so hard and were so tired that he would actually have to lecture them 3 and 4 times before they actually picked up because they couldn't take it all in. Okay, so they were so tired at that particular time that they would say certain things 3 or 4 times a day. I've been told, I wasn't there, obviously, but that's how tired they were. And, I mean, that's a whole different level. I would assume when you train an athlete that hard that, and obviously there were drugs, that there are probably most likely a negative immune system response, and that they will be, there will probably be, I would say, autoimmune diseases later in life that would most likely come up. Maybe I would have to believe that would be a possibility because the stress that those athletes endured are probably second to none. So, and you don't want that. Yeah, obviously you don't want that in your athletes because I do care about their health, and I think there are other ways to do it and do it more effectively, and that's what. But you are right. That was form of regulation. Okay, if he's really bad today, then we'll drop his volume based on his max is terrible today, and we'll go with that.
Interesting. All right, so now let's move off to sequencing of human movement, because this is we had Kurt Hester, and I'm going to give a little plug for Cal, because Kurt Hester of the Dominant One, who's trained a lot of high-level athletes as well, came on the show, and he was talking about eccentric training. He says, you got to have this guy named Cal on the show because he's got these really cool triphasic training. And so much of sport is not about who's the biggest and who's the strongest. It's about the sequencing and how the human movement plays. So I'm really interested to hear, Cal, how do those two things apply? Is that you can be biggest, strongest, fastest, but you might not be the best athlete. How do those two things apply, and how does it go into your book?
Well, so in every dynamic human movement, there are three parts to it. When a quarterback throws a ball, when a sprinter is running and the foot hits the ground, when the baseball pitcher throws a ball, when you change directions. All those are dynamic in my vocabulary, in my world. Now, when you go to, so in the laws of physics tells us every reversible action will have, if it's truly reversible, you have to come to a stop point. You have to break, you have to stop, and you have to go. So the breaking part is called eccentric in our terms. And so if you're running to change directions and you plant that foot to change directions, there is a brief eccentric contraction. Now, what that does is it stops the muscles from lengthening, okay? And what it actually causes, and here's the key, is that you have the tendons, okay, stretched, all right? And when the tendons are stretched, they actually stretch back very quickly. And what they'll do is they will apply. So you actually load a lot of force on that limb. And with the eccentric contraction and the stretch of the tendons, you actually produce free energy in there. So it's like, do you want to run a 40 just normal, or do you want to run a 40 being pulled by a rubber band? Obviously, being pulled by a rubber band is one of the, it's more effective because there's energy being applied to you. Well, that's what the ligaments, our tendons do, okay, to your limb. And the world's best running animals, I'll give you an example, have the longest tendons. So then therefore they store a lot of free energy and they're so efficient because they get a lot of return on that energy from the tendons. So that's the eccentric part. So that's what I train to make that more efficient and get more energy out of the tendons. Now, to come to a complete stop, you have to hit an isometric phase, brief and split, a split second. And even a world-class runner running down the track will have to briefly go into a split-second isometric contraction. And it becomes, and at that point, the sooner that isometric contraction can happen because of the eccentrics and the isometric, the more energy that is going to be propelled to help propel you forward with free energy again. So then what you have is the concentric, the normal contraction to send the ball or the body or anything else forward with a lot of force. So what people don't understand is that you have to actually be able to stop the movement extremely fast and quick before you can propel it extremely fast and quick. Okay? So try to cock a ball in your arm and throw it from a pause position in the back range of motion, throw it only forward. Okay, just stretch back. You're going to see a 100-mile-an-hour pitcher might go to 60 or 50 miles an hour without the stretch reflex. And when I say the eccentric, the isometric, the concentric, the stretch reflex is the most important thing in sports for performance. And that's what I focused on training at that particular point. And that's the true value of the sequencing of human movement. So I just took the normal human movement, analyzed it, and figured out what was going on, and then I broke those up, compartmentalized them into 2 or 3 week blocks, and then trained each of those segments to make the human extremely, extremely much faster or powerful.
Now, this is one thing, too, because we were talking a couple weeks ago about the prevailing theory that they're only strengthening one particular movement of the three that you're mentioning. Could you kind of, did you remember about the concentric and about the explosive and all that? Do you remember, could you kind of fill us in a little bit? Because I thought that was a fascinating position where if everybody is training a certain way for the positive, you're not able to deaccelerate. You're not able to slow yourself down, which is almost more important than the other.
Yeah, I mean, when the quarterback goes to cock his arm back, he's causing energy going backwards, so his muscles, the posterior muscles, the muscles in the back are pulling the arm, but they're really causing a stretch reflex in the muscles that throw the ball forward to make them more powerful and instantaneously hopefully stretch the ligaments, the tendons, so that they can propel the ball forward at a high rate of speed. Okay, same thing when you're running, even running down the track. When that foot slams on the ground, you're causing... there's all this energy there, and if you can't stop it, you can't absorb it into the body to reapply it. So there's a leak in the chain, there's a leak in the person, so that you cannot get that kinetic energy into your kinetic chain to help you push yourself forward. And unless you have that, it's not possible to reach the highest levels. So really, it's like cheating. So you're essentially using all this other free energy to help you move forward because you have high qualities of eccentric and isometric strength.
And now, what is the, you know, like, what are the prevailing ideas in current programs that are causing them to be one-dimensional?
I don't know. I truly believe that you need to really focus on the quality. When I say that, I focus on eccentric more. And then, because if you just do everything all the time, what happens is the body, as I look at the whole body as an organism, or as kind of a whole system, and it has systems within a system, which is really cybernetic system, okay? The term cybernetic comes into play there. But with that in mind, that if you pull the organism in multiple directions, it won't really get better at anything. Okay, I tell people, if you're trying to train for a triathlon, which is the hardest endurance events there is, and then you're trying to train for a powerlifting meet the other days, and you keep mixing those up, you're not really going to be good at anything. Why? Because the organism can't go in all those directions. It can't adapt to the stress of all those things. However, if you come back and you be very specific about what you want to do and stay focused for a week or two and then move on to the next quality, then you have something special because the organism can adapt in 2 to 3 weeks.
Cool. All righty. Now we're going to go back to our kind of the last subject for today, the undulated block and how, you know, because we all have, as strength coaches have been told, well, you need to vary the workout up, you know, because, you know, the body will adapt to it, and once they do, you're not going to get the benefits. But there's more to it than just a simple blanket statement like I just said. Give us an idea. I know you've talked about a little bit through the processor, but what does that mean to you and related to triphasic?
Well, it's a triphasic undulated block model. So by definition, the block model is really a 2 to 3 week period. It can be longer, but mostly it's 2 to 3 weeks. At least for strength, I usually follow a 2 week model that I'll focus on the eccentric strength for 2 weeks. And then I move to the isometric focus for 2 weeks. And I move to the concentric focus on that particular training time for 2 weeks. And this is what everybody's getting great results with. Now, if it's a conditioning focus, let's say before that I'm working a conditioning, I actually have found through the world of biochemistry that it takes about 3 weeks for the body to fully adapt. You'll get adaptations on workout day one, but you won't get the whole benefits until you at least go 3 weeks, because at the cellular level, the enzymes have to take about 3 weeks to fully get to the highest level so that you're functioning in that block. Okay, so with the 3 weeks of conditioning, before I do triphasic, I'll do it in 3 week segments so that we develop the highest levels of those enzymes, so that you can then go into triphasic with all your systems within the system functioning at the highest levels, and then triphasic 2 week blocks of strength performance, basically the eccentric, the isometric, the concentric, come into play, and that will push that person to the highest levels of development within that 6 to 8 week window that you can do triphasic in. And that's basically the block system in a nutshell, and you focus. Now people say, so you're focusing on eccentric strength, are you doing other things? I'm like, yeah, other things, but the focus happens. You know, for example, I've had some advanced strength coaches get in a group and call me and say, Cal, so you had a isometric day and you're doing all this, but you're not doing any running or conditioning, long-term conditioning afterwards. Well, I was like, if you look at my program, my athletes did 20 seconds of hard work every time they went. Their heart rates reached 160, 170, 55 times today. I said, that's enough aerobic work in one day for anybody. So you are getting other effects, but when you're working that hard, my main focus was obviously eccentrics, and you were able to get a huge aerobic effect, and it shows, because people look at my program and say, oh, is there enough aerobic work? Well, my athletes will do often win a lot of the sprint tests, a lot of the so yes, you're getting it, you just might be getting it in a different way. So the block focus is, the 2 week blocks are paramount in developing the highest level of athletes. And also, here's what I found with young athletes, it actually develops them at a high level too, because again, you're not pulling their young bodies in different directions, you're focusing on what they need, and then you move on to the next thing. So I actually found that they can adapt to to the block method also very, very well.
Because let's talk about one aspect. You know, I think we didn't talk about it earlier, but how does the aspect, because one of the, and I'll kind of go to the background, is that one of the things in today's world is athletes are not allowed to recover. Now, you had mentioned it earlier in the conversation that you might give them a Saturday or the weekend off or something like that. But how does your program work in the world of recovery? You know, and is it built in, or is it something that you, oh, you need to have 4 days off a week and then you go every other day? How does that kind of come into play?
So, you know, you have to view recovery, and it's hard for coaches because they always have that hard work mentality, but recovery can be a weapon at times, you know, and that's how we have to look at it. So in my modeling, so here's the one thing about triphasic. Coaches from all across the country said they just slid the methods into their current program. They didn't have to change their program. Nothing has to change in your programming. It just puts these methods into play that are very, very effective, and you can modify the program as it goes. So if they're starting to get tired, I give you ways in triphasic training to just reduce the volume, you know, so that they can get a different workout in. So, for example, if Friday, if you know your athletes are tired, instead of doing the normal heavy workout with a lot of volume too, you can reduce the load, reduce their work sets, and make it kind of a bodybuilding, a light bodybuilding, and it'll actually push blood around to help them recover. Because here's the key to everything, from acupuncture to hot cold tubs to saunas. Here's what happens in recovery. It moves blood around, which gets oxygen to the tissue and nutrients. And that's why you recover. So light bodybuilding will also do the same. Light aerobic work with your heart rate, taking a nice walk at a, you know, or a light jog at 120 beats per minute, keep your heart rate there, or your bike, it will help recovery. Why? Because you're pushing oxygen and nutrients around the body. That's one of the big reasons for recovery. Now, you just got to learn when your athletes are getting tired. You know, at the end, maybe the last week or two of a training cycle, I won't worry about that because then I know they're getting a week or two off. But if you're not getting a week or two off, then you need to accommodate for that. So it's something that has to be played with by the coach. But I would be shocked. Many people are shocked how fast a young athlete recovers, especially with, you know, the high school model, because they have all those hormones running around. It's crazy.
It is amazing how fast they adapt. I have noticed that when you do some sort of, like, coordination training, if you have somebody that has some substance, it comes quick. And what it, you have to challenge them almost in more ways than older athletes, you know, from the standpoint.
There's no question. They're amazing. They're amazing specimens in that regard.
Cool. All right. In the last 3 or 4 minutes here, anything else that you could think of that would kind of tie this conversation together?
As I said before, I think the whole concept with the triphasic training is it just takes some things that coaches have done in the past, tried and true methods, and puts them in a sequencing order for people to completely understand that they can slide into their program right now and get some huge benefits and really help the athletes, because that's what it's all about. You know, this book wasn't about me writing a book. It was more about sharing my methods. And as I said, I've received so many benefits from that. I've been very fortunate. And, we're actually working on a second book. And people have heard about it. I've had requests, you know. But ultimately, it'll probably be a year before we get it done because I'm so busy. We're busy coaching versus writing books. And I really didn't write the first one. My co-author did. He took my dictations and reworded it. And I did a great job on the book in regards to picking the co-author, because Ben was the most beneficial, and he's finishing up his PhD work here at the University of Minnesota. And his PhD will be in part of the second book in regards to the bioenergetics and repeated sprint ability, which is very, very important, obviously, in training your ability in football to go at 100%. 13, 14 plays in a row and not fatigue, or in soccer to sprint and then rest a little bit and sprint again and stay and keep your speed up during the course of a game. That's what his research is in. It's some of the most extensive stuff I've ever seen on it. So I think it should be a, an awesome thing. And basically, we've tied it all together in the system and in conditioning and training for people to read. We're pretty excited about it. I just know it'll take a while between him getting his PhD and me being a full-time coach. Obviously, yeah, to work nights and weekends on this stuff is about the only time to do it.
Amazing stuff. Well, where can people get a hold of you if they would like to get some questions out to you or...
My website XO Athlete has emails that you can email me and ask questions and so forth and pick up a copy of the book. Usually the questions for triphasic training, most of them are answered in the book. I'll get questions from people that haven't completely read it. I say it's at the end and they'll get that. But again, I don't know if there's another book out there or be honest with you, I don't know if there's another strength coach that's thrown more programs out there on the internet than I have. Just because, you know, and you set yourself up for scrutiny, but I'm like, that's okay, because every situation is different. It's not one that I'm afraid of, so.
Cool. All righty, Cal, thank you very much for spending the time today. I know the people that I've talked to about your books, and you really have influenced, for sure, the state of Minnesota. You know, I haven't left the state of Minnesota very often, but just to let everybody know, I mean, there's probably of the top 5-6 jobs in the state of Minnesota, I think Cal's touched them all, it seems like. But thank you for coming on the show, and if you would like to get a hold of Cal, we're also going to have it on our website, XL Athlete, and he actually is, his site is one of our sponsors as well, and have tremendous feedback from the people related to that. So thank you, Cal.
Thank you, Steve, for having me. It was a pleasure, and hopefully I'll be back.
Absolutely. Well, there you go. I again, we're going to have the information and the links up on our website. That's themccarthyproject.com to connect right to Cal's books and different other gear. He's got a lot of equipment. He's got a lot of the Soviet reviews up there. Really has done a great job in trying to get the information out to people. And that's one of the things. And I actually have a relationship that goes back with Cal for probably 8-9 years now. And he has always been gracious to help. And literally, he has influenced a tremendous number of coaches here in the Minnesota area, as well as on a nationwide and probably even a worldwide level. So thank you, Cal. Okay, from that standpoint, thank you for coming. Thank you for listening today. We'll be back tomorrow with the recipe of the day with Jess Sarah, Fit by Jess, Fit Food by Jess, and then also Leslie Patterson, Xterra World Champion. We'll be talking about the Braveheart Brick and some other training methods that she has for triathletes. Thank you. We look forward to talking with you again tomorrow. And if you have any questions, just get a hold of us at our website. Thanks. Five Star Basketball, the leader in basketball instruction and camps. Endorsed by Michael Jordan, Dick Vitale, and Hubie Brown. And where the teaching never stops. Five Star Basketball Minnesota will be hosting a one-day instructional camp on May 18th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. and will be hosted by Five Star, the McCarthy Project, and Grassroots Hoops. For more information on the camp, visit themccarthyproject.com/5-star. XL Athlete is the leading provider of online strength and conditioning and speed development camps. For more information on their training programs and speed development camps, visit xlathlete.com.